evening and welcome. My name is Michael Mackey. I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the other organizers of the Cutting Edge Lecture to the last of the 2009-10 series. Before I say any more, if you're packing a mobile phone, could you please turn it off or at least put it on silent? The Cutting Edge Lectures have been going on for a number of years now. They were conceived of by several of us in the Faculty of Science and the Faculty of Medicine as a way of trying to get experts in various fields of science to communicate the excitement of their findings and their fields to non-experts. Because too often, actually almost always, we hear seminars and talks by experts and nobody can really understand what's going on except three or four people in the audience. And tonight we have over 120 people who've come to hear one of McGill's own experts talking about his field. The Cutting Edge Lectures are very generously supported by the McGill administration. The principal and the provost, Heather Monroe-Broom and Tony Massey, respectively, the dean of science, Martin Grant, the dean of medicine, Richard Levin, and the newly formed Center for Applied Mathematics and Biology and Medicine here at McGill. Tonight's speaker is Gil Holder. He's in the Department of Physics here at McGill and received his undergraduate and master's level training at Queen's University and then went on to get his doctorate at the University of Chicago. He's been at McGill since 2005 and he holds a CRC chair in cosmology and astrophysics, and he's also a scholar of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. Now, earlier this week, I went to visit my mother for Easter and her birthday, and I had the great pleasure of seeing a very newly released film, IMAX film, called Hubble. And in that film, you watch the astronauts repair the Hubble telescope for the second time, and then you see some of the images that are being sent back, which are truly, totally mind-blowing, because we start to see the beginnings of our own universe, reaching back further and further and further. And tonight, Gil Holder is going to talk about some of those when he tells us about the first stars and the end of the dark ages. Gil?
Okay, so it's a pleasure to be here and see so many people interested in the first stars and the end of the dark ages. So I hope we didn't accidentally hook some classicists in here or something that are hoping for something I might not be giving you. Okay, so I've been here at McGill for a while now, and of course our research in general is supported through the Canadian government and through the Quebec government, and it's very nice to get that. But something which has been very useful for the whole enterprise of cosmology and gravity in Canada is this thing, the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. So they're a private foundation that actually has endowed some amount of money to people that are working on various disciplines. And if you're looking for interesting ways to fund science and research in general, I encourage you to look that way. Okay, so I'll give you a summary of what this talk is. So this is a slide from the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, and what it is it's showing the history of our universe. And so it's basically this way down here is time. So this is the beginning of time as far as we can tell down here, and here's roughly where we are today, and here was the satellite doing all these wonderful observations. This way is basically the size of the universe. So we live in an expanding universe, and you can see that because as you move to the right, this thing is getting bigger. So that's what it... Now, when you sort of look back in time, so we're here looking back in time, as you look further and further back, you see all sorts of things. You see galaxies and stars. As you look further away, you see other galaxies and other stars, and you go all the way back, and where we currently are, so that movie that we just heard about, that wonderful movie, is seeing stuff right around there. And that's about as far back as we can go these days with the best telescopes, and we're just pushing... That's the new frontier, is pushing all the way back to right here. Going the other way, there was a big bang. At some point, the universe sort of popped into existence for whatever reason. No one really knows. This is sort of the domain of string theorists and philosophers and theologians. So something happened. We don't really know what. The universe started expanding. Lots of crazy things happened. And then the last thing we see is right around here, from about when the universe was 380,000 years old, there was all this light left over from the Big Bang, and that right there suddenly just stopped interacting with the universe, because the universe went through a bit of a phase transition. And so we see this light, and we've characterized it amazingly well, and that was the topic of a talk last year in this Cutting Edge series. But in between, there is this thing called the Dark Ages. And it's kind of a weird thing, because there's basically no new light that's been generated in the universe. And so this right here is 380,000 years. We think the first stars were around 400 million. So there's this huge gap of time where lots of things in principle happen, but we can't see anything. There is no light coming from in here, and that's why it's called the Dark Ages. And then once the first stars formed, it suddenly lifted the veil, and suddenly we could start measuring the universe again. And so what I'm going to talk about is why these Dark Ages are there, what was going on, and then what happened to get these first stars to form, and then I'm going to talk about how we're going to try to measure this in the future. Okay, so here's the outline. I'm going to start with an overview of the Big Bang, just to make sure we're all caught up on the expanding universe. And basically, the punchline of the Big Bang is that the universe used to be really, really hot, and then it got old. Read into that what you want. So now it's very cold and dilute. It's about 3 Kelvin when you look around, whereas it used to be as hot as you could imagine and even hotter. Then I'm going to give an overview of star formation. This is an ongoing area in astrophysics where we're trying to understand what's going on in details in star formation. We have an idea of the big picture of how stars form and why they more or less look the way they do. So I'll give you a quick overview of that, try to give you a flavor for what's going on. Then we'll talk about the first stars and hopefully get a flavor for how it's different from just the everyday boring furnace of stars in the nearby universe. And then I'll talk about searching for the first stars. And here's this word, searching for. So I don't know how many of you are academics, but there are rules for when you read papers. If you see a paper that the title ends in a question mark, the answer is no. And if you see searching for, it means we haven't found anything yet. We haven't found anything yet, but this is sort of the next decade of discovery. We'll be turning radio telescopes, microwave telescopes, millimeter infrared optical, even gamma ray telescopes, to really try to nail down what's going on with the first stars. All right. So, the universe is expanding, and this leads to all sorts of conceptual difficulties. What does it mean for the universe to be expanding? How do we wrap our head around this? There's basically two parts to understand. One is that you can really imagine the universe is some big block that really is getting bigger over time. For whatever reason, it started really small, and it's just been getting bigger. The other thing that is a crucial part of this is that light takes a certain amount of time to get anywhere, in the same way that sound takes a certain amount of time to get anywhere. And the speed of light, sort of a nice rule of thumb, is it's about a foot per nanosecond. So if you wait a billionth of a second, light can go about a foot. So if you're 10 feet away, that's 10 nanoseconds different. So in between the front and the back of the room, there's a few nanoseconds delay. We're actually not quite synced up in terms of time. So for reference, that's about a million times the speed of sound. So we've all seen lightning, and you see that there's the lightning flash, and you wait. Well, if we did the same thing with the actual light, there'd be a lag that's about a million times shorter. However, the universe is really big, right? So we measure the universe in terms of light years, and a light year, so if you say in a billionth of a second it goes a foot, then in a second it goes a billion feet, and you start adding all these things up, and you end up getting into numbers that are, where you start getting into things like 10 to the 18 or 10 to the 19, 1 with 19 zeros, centimeters in a year. So these are big numbers. Now, so the universe is expanding. How can we understand that? So this thing right here is a picture of what's known as the Sloan Great Wall. It's one of the largest scale structures in the reasonably local universe. It's, it's something like some number of hundreds of millions of light years away. So we consider that reasonably local. And so here's a picture of it. And it's taken a slice just so you don't see all sorts of other confusing things. Now, as we look out, we're looking back in time. So if we're looking at something that is reasonably nearby, it didn't take light very long to get to us. So when I look at the people in the front row, light got to me from them very quickly. The people at the back, it took a little bit longer, which means as I look out, I'm looking further back. So anything that I see that's reasonably nearby is reasonably young. It came from not very far into the distant past, which says the universe was almost as big then as it is today. If we go a little further out, it took light a long time to get to us. And as light was getting to us, the whole universe was stretching, including the light, which meant that light that comes from further away is going to be stretched. And when if you take light and you stretch it, it becomes redder. But in general, it's just stretched. If you go even further away, this light has been traveling for some reasonable chunk of the age of the universe, which means the universe has been stretching the whole time. The light's been stretching along with the universe. So this stuff out here, the light looks much more stretched than the stuff that's right here. So as you look out, what you see is that stuff that's further away has been stretched. It's been redshifted. So the spectrum looks like it's coming from something which is much is much redder. And this is what's known as a cosmological redshift. And this is how it was discovered. Another way to make things look redder is for them to be moving very quickly. It's a Doppler effect. That when you see a fire truck go by, you hear the siren and you hear it as a higher frequency when it's coming towards you and lower as it's going away. And it's the same effect. So what people early on they did was they attributed this the fact that things further away looked red. They said, oh, it must be moving away from us. So stuff moving away from us is moving more quickly. And then it led to this sort of funny thing where it seemed like the whole universe was rushing away from us. And so that led to all sorts of problems about why the universe hates us and all these other things. But it turns out that a perfectly reasonable explanation of all of this is that the universe is just getting bigger. And there's no center to this. So we're not at the center of some universe that's rushing away from us. The whole universe is just stretching. Because notice that you could do the same exercise over here. If you could draw a little circle over here around this guy. And then that circle will be a little bigger this way and a little bigger this way. So there's no center to this expansion. The whole universe is just getting bigger. Now, you can take this thing and run it backwards. You can say the universe is getting bigger. There was a Big Bang. Things are stretching out. Things are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But you can equally well say, okay, well, let's go back in time and try to understand what's going on. And what's happening is this stuff is all getting closer and closer together, which is to say, at some point in the past, the entire observable universe was basically packed into one point, as far as we can tell. So lots of people argue about whether it was actually a point or whether there was some kind of funny bounce from some previous universe or whether we tunneled into there from somewhere else. But again, I'm going to leave that to the string theorists, the philosophers, and the theologians. Because once you get down to here, there are very few observable probes, as far as we can tell. So if we are working on finding out how to measure what happened down there, but right now we have no way of doing that, so we're working on that. Okay, and so what this means is that down here the universe was extremely hot as you can imagine. And ever since then it's just been thinning out and getting colder. And so you can imagine, it's not hard to understand why it's getting colder. If you imagine some piece of the universe had a little heater in it, if the whole universe is stretching, everyone's getting further away from the heater, everyone's cooling off, right? So the universe is cooling down and getting much, much bigger. Now, so what are the milestones of the Big Bang? So what we think, if you want to talk about just imagining what was going on at a picosecond, so some ridiculously small fraction of a second, we think that quarks emerged from the primordial plasma. So this is things they're trying to measure, I guess at RIC, but also the LHC is going to have something to say about things like this. Around a nanosecond, we think that that's when protons and neutrons form. So that was the first time anyone could really start doing any kind of, not even chemistry yet, but nuclear physics at least. So that's where we first had the concept of a proton and a neutron. If you went back before a billionth of a second, it made no sense to even talk about a proton or a neutron. The whole universe was so hot, it would just split those things apart as fast as they popped into existence. Now, this stuff is expected to be there because we're just running the clock backwards. The first point where we actually have any sort of data is around a minute. And a minute is where we think the elements form. So helium and lithium, maybe some deuterium, a little bit of helium-3, some beryllium possibly, all the light elements. And what we see is that if everything's consistent with the universe having been hot enough to basically be a little nuclear reactor at around a minute. And the reason we know that is because you can predict exactly what the pattern of elements should be, hydrogen to helium to lithium. And they should be in the ratio of 1 to 0.1 to a part in 10 billion. And when we observe that, what we see is 1 to 0.1 to 2 parts in 10 billion. And then people argue and go, oh, my God, it's 2 parts in 10 billion instead of 1. What are we going to do? But come on, it's 10 billion, right? The 10 billion is the reasonable part of this. And so all of these things point to the universe having been at around 10 to the 10 Kelvin, so 10 billion Kelvin at around a minute. And then after that, nothing really happened until about 300,000 years. Because remember, once you form all these elements, you have your hydrogen, you have your helium, you have lithium, and just the nuclei. They have no electrons around them, and the reason for that is because they're running into each other so fast that even if you hung an electron on one, it would get pinged off super fast. So around 300,000 years, the universe cooled down enough that you could actually form normal atoms. So this is a helium atom, at least according to the Wikipedia. So way down there at the center is the nucleus. So two protons and two neutrons. So for our purposes, you can pick which two are which. And then a big cloud of electrons around it. And so that happened at 300,000 years. That before then, you had no atoms of any kind. And then suddenly at around 300,000 years, all these nuclei glommed on, they got all their electrons around them, and then you could start doing things like thinking about chemistry. Then you can start saying, if I take two things and bring them close to each other, what happens? So nothing interesting could happen until then. But the sad thing is that this is exactly when the Dark Ages started. This is when everything fell apart, because all of these nuclei gobbled up all these electrons, they sucked them up in there, and then they just kind of sat there, and they're basically done. Now, if that had been the whole story, nothing else would have happened for the rest of the universe. That the universe would have just kept expanding and cooling off and expanding and cooling off, expanding, cooling off. We wouldn't have any of the stuff around us, because everything we see around us is, you know, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, all these very interesting things, which didn't come out of the Big Bang. All the stuff that we see around us was basically formed in stars. And if this was the whole story, we would never have had any stars. So there's a very important piece that's missing. And the thing that's missing is gravity. So there's a Radiohead song, Fake Plastic Trees, where there's this great line that says, used to do surgery, girls in the 80s, but gravity always wins. So, of course, they're talking about plastic surgery, but it's the same effect, that you just can't beat gravity, because gravity's always pulling. It's taking things and it's just shoving them together, which means that any two things, you have two red balls attached to a spring, or if you want to imagine this as some kind of a molecule, they're always getting attracted to each other. No matter what happens, they're always getting pulled together. There's never a push in gravity, which means it's one way. It's almost like a ratchet that it pulls down and it never gives back. It always pulls, and it just pulls and it pulls and it pulls. And it's relentless, and it's going to get us in the end. You can't fight it, that, you know, eventually all of the matter in the universe is probably going to end up in a black hole somewhere. And maybe it'll get re-radiated out of some sort of useless particle bath that no one can process, but eventually it's going to win. It's not what's going to do us in. You know, we'll get hit by an asteroid, our sun will die. I don't know what else will happen. Lots of bad things will happen long before then. But gravity will get us. There's no fighting it. And it's because it's relentless. It's the weakest of the forces, but it only pulls one way. So you will always lose to it in the end. In the short term, though, obviously we're beating gravity, right? We are standing. I am standing here. You guys are sitting up. The things in your body is beating gravity with no problem. But in the long run, it's tough to beat. And the universe has been here for 13.7 billion years, which means gravity's been working for 13.7 billion years, slowly pulling. All right, so what has it been doing for 13.7 billion years? Well, so what we can do is we can run big giant simulations on supercomputers and say, well, let's start with what we think came out of the Big Bang and run the movie forward and say, what does gravity do? And that's what this is. And if you start around 400,000 years, this is what gravity has done. Basically nothing, as far as you can tell. It has done little tiny things. If you measure very carefully, you can see that gravity has been working, but it hasn't done much. Around 20 million years, if you really squint and if you're up near the front, ooh, it's much better up there. Yeah. Wow. There's lots of stuff going on up there, right? So it's starting to get somewhere at around 20 million years, but it still isn't quite there yet. At 500 million years, now you can see something has really happened. Basically, gravity has just been pulling and pulling and pulling. You had some little lump somewhere that was a little bit heavier than everything around it, and it's just been pulling everything in, slowly but steadily, for 500 million years, and that's where it's gotten to. It's pulled enough stuff in here that on this color scale, this thing's popped out as red. And this is where the first stars are going to form, is right there. That's the story we're going to get to. This is where the first stars formed. And then you keep running that thing forward, and you get to today, where gravity has actually done quite a good job. That when you look out and... So it's not necessarily what you see with your eye, because when you look up in the sky, you're mainly just seeing our galaxy. But if you look at, that Hubble movie that you were talking about, you see the sort of filaments and large-scale structure in galaxies. That's been just gravity working for 13.7 billion years. All right. So it's not just gravity, though. On the one hand, you have gravity squeezing. Gravity's always pulling in, but in the short term, it's getting resistance. Pressure is resisting us. So whether it's the little molecules in your body that gravity's pulling it in, you know, gravity's pulling my head down, my neck is resisting it, and then you have, at the molecular level, there's some resistance going on where gravity's pulling stuff in, and there's some part of me that's pushing back. And that can go on, will comfortably go on for 76 years or whatever the mean age is. I'm not going to lose to gravity, but I would if I was to go for 13.7 billion years, I suspect. So gravity's pulling in, and then all of the other physics and chemistry that we know is basically fighting gravity and saying, okay, well, enough pulling for now. Let's not worry about that. But all of that has the effect of raising up the temperature of the gas. That if you just take some big ball of gas and you stick it in gravity, gravity pulls on it. And when gravity pulls it in, it's going to contract. And as it contracts, it's going to get hotter. And so I think this is what many of us have learned in high school. There's some ideal gas law that says PV equals NRT or something like that. But as a physicist, I don't really like to think about things in those terms. I like to think about what's going on in terms of little balls rattling around. And so for our purposes, if you imagine the universe is just a bunch of little balls rattling around, so here's our universe or some cloud of gas or something like that, and here are things in there. It doesn't even matter what they are. We won't even give them any names. So every time something bounces off a wall, which is what's going on there, and it's much clearer up there, every time it bounces off a wall, that wall is going to feel some bounce. And that's what pressure is stuff bouncing off a wall, or alternatively, every time this ball bounces off that ball, it gives it a little kick. So pressure is just saying that every time you have something changing direction, it imparts some kick to it. And that's all pressure is. But it's all, as far as physicists do this, it's all little balls kicking around, rattling off things. And all temperature is saying how fast these balls are moving around and how heavy they are. It's just the energy of each ball is temperature. So if something is really hot, then you have these balls moving around really fast. If something's really cold, these balls are barely moving. If they're moving very fast, you'll also get big kicks off the wall, which means the pressure's high. So this is sort of the way I like to understand what I learned in high school, I think, as the ideal gas law, PV equals NRT. But it's that, you know, it's nice to know the equation, but it's a hard way to understand it. And so one way to think about what's going on is what happens if I take this box and I squeeze it. I have some big box, and I just make it smaller. So if you use an equation, what it'll tell you is that things will get hotter. If you take a box and you squeeze it, it gets hotter. But what's really going on? What's really going on is you have one of these, you have balls rattling around. So imagine you have this yellow ball, and it's just moving at some speed, rattling around the box. If I make that box smaller, it'll be able to move around the box in a shorter amount of time. And in particular, if I have something sitting here totally quiet, it's just sitting there completely cold, this ball's rattling around the room. As it rattles around, it'll take some amount of time to hit this. As soon as it hits it, that energy gets absorbed, and suddenly this thing's warmed up a little bit. If that box is smaller, this thing is going to take a smaller amount of time to rattle around that box, which means it's going to raise this thing's energy in a shorter amount of time. Which means if I have a bunch of balls rattling around in a smaller box, this red thing is going to absorb a lot more particles, which means it's going to have more energy, which means it's hotter. So just making the box smaller all by itself will have the effect of, in the long run, making things in it hotter. And this is the ideal gas law, and you really don't need this for many things in chemistry or even a lot of physics, but when you're doing astrophysics, in the end, we always end up reducing things to little balls rattling around, because sometimes in astrophysics, you can get the case where it'll take so long for this thing to circumnavigate that it'll never run into anything, and then actually nothing interesting happens at all. Okay, but that's not the whole story. We still can't form stars just by heating things up. The sun didn't form to be as hot as it is just because it got squeezed until it got really, really hot. Something much more complicated happened. And that complicated thing goes by the name of cooling, which is to say it got heated up and then it actually got cold, which sounds crazy, right? How do you get to something that's millions of Kelvin by cooling? Well, so we have to think about that for a bit. All right. So let's skip over that. We don't need all this stuff. All right. So what is this? This is a picture of the Orion Nebula, M42. So as you're looking at this thing, so there's some picture of Orion, which is in the public domain because it's very, very old. And there's Orion. And so Orion's right there. There's one star, two stars, three stars, four. If I can see that, it's probably easier to see there. Yeah. One, two, three, four. And there's his belt. So when you go out and you look outside, you should always try to find Orion in the winter. It's really quite spectacular. And but there's a lot of very interesting stuff happening, unfortunately, right there. And I didn't even notice how unfortunate it was until I tried to put an arrow on this. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't do that. But I did, so... And so all along his sword, so they've at least put a sword there, right? I mean, thank God. All along his sword, you have all sorts of regions like this. And so this thing here is a few light years across. And what it is, it's a region of very intense star formation. And you can almost kind of see it in back there. You can see that there's sort of a glowing spot. And that's where there's a star in behind, and it's, you know, it's shining and it's trying to burn its way through all this stuff. But you also see all sorts of other amazing things. Like you see these big tendrils, and this is what we call dust. It's really sort of agglomerations of particles, anywhere from nanometer scales up to almost millimeter scales. And it's just blocking the light. So this is just, it really is just stuff that blocks light as far as most people are concerned. But all of these things are crucial to the story of how stars form in the local universe, because the dust plays a... So dust is one way that stuff cools, but also a lot of this emission that you see is actually stuff cooling off. So what we're seeing is the action of star formation itself because we can see it. That whenever you see light, it's almost always because something's cooling off. And in this case... this is some big giant cloud of stuff that's cooling off, and it's cooling off through atomic transitions. So you have little carbon atoms and oxygen atoms that are making their little transitions. You also have vibrating molecules, and the vibrating molecules are emitting infrared photons. And these dust things are also vibrating like crazy back and forth and emitting light in the far infrared. So all of the stuff you're seeing here is at work cooling this cloud off. And as it cools off, that's what's allowing it to form stars. So stay with me on this one. So what's going on? Well, this isn't the way you cool off. The way you cool off is you're sitting there. So I guess actually none of us are cooling off very much right now. It's pretty odd in here, right? The way you cool off is you have some cold particles around that bounce off your arm or your skin. They bounce off, they're a little bit colder, and they carry away some amount of energy. And then eventually that stuff moves away, some new cold thing comes in and carries it away. But it's always, you have some internal motions that need to get sort of passed on to someone else and carried away. It turns out that doesn't work very well in stars, or in the process of forming stars. The way generally things get rid of energy is actually by radiating, by sending out infrared light or optical light or X-ray light or however it's cooling. And the primary way to do that is through collisions. So this is as technical as the talk is going to get. So collisions lead to cooling. So if you can internalize that, then you're good to go. What does that mean? Well, what it means is if you have two things and they're just moving around. And so you have two balls attached to springs, and they run into each other. So I wish I could do the demonstration, but I'm not sure I could get them to run into each other properly. But you can imagine what's going to happen. They're going to bounce off, and at the same time, the two ends are going to start bouncing back and forth, right? So you're going to end up with two springs that are now going in the opposite directions of where they were when they came in. They bounced off each other. But at the same time, those two... Each spring is vibrating back and forth. Now, if it's vibrating back and forth, what's going to happen is they're going to be moving more slowly than they were when they started. So if you're defining how hot something is by how fast the little bits are moving around, then you've cooled this gas off just by having two things run into each other. So that's step one. So you need things to run into each other to damp out that motion, that large-scale motion of stuff zipping all over the place. So that's step one. Now, you still have this problem that these two things are running into each other. And if you imagine you had some spring and you have this thing really going back and forth with a lot of energy, even if it's sitting there, I could have some other particle come in really slowly and it's going to go ping and go flying out as it bounces off it. So you don't want that. You need some mechanism to stop this thing from bouncing back and forth. And that's where you need quantum mechanics to save you. And what happens is that eventually, if you take some molecule and have it bouncing back and forth like this, after some amount of time, light will come out. That's actually how you generate light, is you take things and you take charges and you shake them back and forth. That's a different talk. But in the end, these things de-excite, as we call it, these oscillations de-excite when they get converted into either heat, sound, or light. And as soon as that happens, and what you end up with is you end up with the large-scale motions are getting damped down, which is to say it's getting colder. So this is when I realized that physicists are obviously different from the man on the street, right? Because in what way is this considered cooling? Right? Very few people feel cooler after they've gotten a head-on wreck. However, imagine how fast these two things were going, right? These things were going at some number of large, you know, probably 50 kilometers an hour, and they ran into each other head-on. That's a lot of energy. These things are coming, you know, two big lumps moving very quickly, running into each other. And all that energy got dissipated as either heat, sound, or light. So it's all gone. And so while it's true that it made a bit of a mess, this is actually cooling. But it also has the other... we'll get there in a second. So that's step one. So here it is. So you have two things run into each other. These things start oscillating back and forth. Eventually some little bit of light or sound or something comes out of this thing, and then you're left with something that's cooler. Now, we have this curious thing that things run into each other more often when there are more things to run into, right? So you have some big cloud of things, you're going to get more collisions going on. So the denser the environment, the more collisions, which means the more collisions, the more cooling. So now let's go back to this picture. So we have gravity squeezing, pressures resisting. The gas was hot enough, let's say, that pressure was matching the gravity. It was in perfect equilibrium. You had some big ball, and it was just sitting there. It was perfect. Everything was great. Suddenly, two things run into each other, and some little bit of energy leaves the system, which means it's now cooler. So it's cooler now, which means it's not hot enough to not sag, so it sags. So this whole cloud now sags a little bit. It sags down until it heats up again, until it's hot enough to stop to match gravity. So it was perfect, it radiated, now it has to heat up again, which means it shrinks. So that's what's going on. However, it shrunk, which means it now has more collisions, which means it cools faster, which means, so there it is, shrinking. But it's now at a higher density, which means it's going to radiate faster, which means it's going to cool down faster, which means it has to shrink faster, which means it goes to higher density faster. So you end up with this cooling runaway, and we actually call it the cooling catastrophe. And it's a catastrophe that we've formed a star and managed to make ourselves, right? That's the way physicists work. So what happens is when you have some little parcel of gas, as soon as it starts to cool a little bit, it'll shrink, and then it'll cool even faster, and then it'll shrink faster, and then it cools faster, and it shrinks faster. And you just get this runaway. We're almost on the time it takes just by gravity alone, it would just collapse down to a point. This whole thing just starts contracting down and radiating like crazy. And so while this is happening, the thing can break into smaller chunks. So the people that can look up here can hopefully see that these are smaller chunks. And it's radiating ever faster, radiating away, radiating, shrinking, radiating, shrinking. So now you maybe can get an idea why this getting cooler is so critical to forming a star, because that's the only way to really contract by this huge factor. And in fact, this thing keeps on going, and it won't stop until it is actually so compact that when it creates some new bit of radiation, it can't get out. which is to say, if you have a big chunk of lead, you know that even an X-ray can't get through it. And so in the same way, once the cloud gets to a high enough density, even though it's creating, it's trying to send the energy out of the system, it just doesn't get out. And once it gets to that point, the cloud basically gets into its new equilibrium and just sits there. And if you sort of run the numbers on this, what you end up with is you end up with something about a tenth of a solar mass. So this is the sense in which we sort of understand what's going on in star formation. That just using this simple argument for saying things keep contracting and they stop when they can't radiate anymore, you get something like a tenth of a solar mass. And if you look in our galaxy, that's kind of the characteristic mass of stars. Now, what's happened here is cosmic compaction. And just to get a sense of what I mean by this, if you look in this Hubble Ultra Deep Field, and hopefully you can look in this one because it's much nicer, if you were to just pick some empty patch somewhere maybe over there and say, what's the density in that patch? It's some very, not too far away. What you'll get is you'll get about one hydrogen atom in your gas tank. So if you take something, I don't know, you have about one hydrogen atom in that whole thing. In the sun, it's the density of water. And the density of water is 1 gram per cubic centimeter. So that's the mean density in the sun. So it's gone through this huge, massive contraction where it's gone through, can I get this number right? Something about 30 orders of magnitude in density. So it's contracted by this huge factor. And all of this was enabled by cooling. And all it started with was two little things running into each other and emitting some light. And as soon as you could do that, then you just started this runaway process that got you from some little empty generic spot between there into being able to form these stars. And you needed a little bit of gravity to kickstart it. So you couldn't have just picked some random spot in the universe with nothing there at all. You need a little bit of gravity. But other than that, you're good to go. And that's how stars form. Now, what I've skipped over is what the spring is. And so the spring is quantum mechanics. It's the fact that electrons don't like to be too close to each other, and this is not the place to discuss quantum mechanics. But in general, it's just molecules. So here's a carbon monoxide molecule. So one of these is carbon and one of them is oxygen. So probably the bigger one, I guess, is this. So I think these are probably actually flipped, but it's okay. These things are sort of glued together by electrons, and they sort of can jiggle back and forth and make light that way. So when two carbon monoxide molecules run into each other, they'll start jiggling and eventually emit some little bit of infrared light. You can also do this with either oxygen. So oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon are extremely good at this, which is to say if you have some carbon or oxygen-nitrogen molecule around and they run into each other, they have lots of electrons and there's lots of them. So when two of them run into each other, it's very easy to take an electron and kick it around in energy. So here's the Bohr model of the atom, which is you have your nucleus and a bunch of electrons going around it. And every time you get a transition between levels, light comes out. So all you have to do is get two of these things to run into each other, cause an electron to jump up to this N equals 3 level, it decays back down, and light comes out. And it turns out that this is a very efficient way of getting light out of the interstellar medium. And in fact, a lot of the... In that beautiful image, a lot of what the light you're seeing is coming from these transitions. So some of it's from hydrogen, but I think oxygen's one of the biggest coolants, and carbon's a big one as well. However, you need to make sure that stuff is moving fast enough to at least kick one of these electrons from, say, here up to there. So there's a threshold which says gas has to be somewhere around 10 to the 4 Kelvin, 10,000 Kelvin, before this really works very well. So this can work at actually right down in the hundreds of Kelvin. So, this works on Earth, basically, or maybe, even colder than where we are on Earth. But for this, you need 10,000 Kelvin. So you're not going to get anything happening this way until you get to 10,000 Kelvin. And that's what's going on in most of this stuff. It's all of these things are at work. Now, what's the problem? I just said star formation makes total sense. Why are we spending all this time looking for the first stars? Well, the first stars don't have carbon, they don't have oxygen, they don't have nitrogen. They only have hydrogen and helium, and as Rocky Cobb says, a little bit of lithium to help it get through the day. That's all they have, which means they don't have a lot of different ways to cool, and they don't in particular have carbon monoxide or any interesting molecules whatsoever. The only molecule you might hope to form is molecular hydrogen. And for various reasons, molecular hydrogen turns out to be a really lousy molecule for doing any sort of cooling. And it's basically because it's just two hydrogens. It's really lousy for it. You can do it if you need to, but people, it doesn't work very well. So there's no interesting molecules, and there's no heating or radiation from other stars. So it's, you know, the very first stars had a rough go of it. And what we think is that the first stars, instead of forming something that looked like this, ended up looking like this. Just a few very blue dots with none of this wonderful structure because they don't have any of this dust. There's nothing obscuring anything because that's all interesting chunks of stuff. And chunks of stuff is carbon and hydrogen. So there's no carbon, so there's no interesting chunks. There's hardly any of this diffuse emission because a lot of that's coming from oxygen and nitrogen and carbon. So it has a tough go of it. And basically what it has to do is it has to wait until a hydrogen atom can make this jump, which is to say it has to wait until the universe, until its local area is 10,000 Kelvin. So here's the answer to why the dark ages are there. So the dark ages are there because nothing was hot enough to cool down. Weird, right? So that's the mystery. So what's going on? Remember, gravity is taking its sweet time, right? The universe is evolving. It started as being very low density, these little tiny ripples right here, which again are much clearer over there. So there it's very smooth, and gravity is slowly, slowly getting these big giant gravitational potential wells that it's pulling the gas into and squeezing. And it takes time. And so when the universe was here, it just, these little bright peaks were not quite bright enough to squeeze the gas up to 10,000 Kelvin. But then magically, right around here, at some point, some chunk of the universe got up to 10,000 Kelvin, and that very first collision happened that sent light out. And then the whole cascade started, and we started forming stars. And then today, and then those stars basically created their carbon and their oxygen and sputtered across its local area, and then those areas could actually start doing interesting chemistry and cooling very fast. But you needed this first one to get going before you could do anything. Sort of the, okay. So, and there it is. So right there, you can do it. And so this is why the dark ages are a sharp transition. That's why suddenly you went from having nothing interesting at all to a few stars and then a bunch of stars all at once, and then the universe evolved as we expected, or as we've observed it to go. Not necessarily what we expected. Certainly not at all as I would have expected. Okay. Now, so in the next sort of decade or so, in addition to trying to figure out theoretically what's going on, so I'm a theoretical astrophysicist, so I like working on the theory side of things, but I also like to stay involved in experiments. It keeps you grounded, keeps you working on things that are relevant. And so I'm involved in, at least three sort of different ways of looking for the first star. So one way is to look in the radio. And I'll show you how that works in a second. Another way is to work in the millimeter or in the microwave. You can look in the infrared, and that's sort of the next big NASA mission, is the James Webb Space Telescope. And it's one of its main science goals is to be imaging these first stars. And you can also look in the optical, which is what those images from Hubble were looking in the optical. So let's start with the radio. So where people are looking right now and not expecting to find very much, but just because you're not expecting to find very much doesn't stop you from looking because you never know what you might find, are using things like the Very Large Array. So this is in Socorro, New Mexico. So if you've seen Contact, this is what they were doing, looking for aliens using the Very Large Array. So there's a search going on there. But Socorro, New Mexico has a lot of things like television channels. And for when you're looking halfway across the universe, it turns out that channel 8 over the hill can actually drown out a lot of the signals you're looking for. So that's one of the things they're fighting there. In the longer term is this thing called the Square Kilometer Array. And so this is, I think, something like 2020 is the current scale for this. And so for scale, this thing over here, there's a shadowy bump over there that no one can see. That's a truck. And the square kilometer refers to the combined collecting area of the telescopes. And so it's roughly 100 times more area of telescope. And if you take each one of these little circles and add them all up, it's almost 100 times more. And that's what we're aiming to do. And so Canada's a big player in this. We are historically a strong country in radio astronomy. And we expect to keep going in this. And this is one of the most promising ways to figure out what's going on with the first stars, which you might think is a little odd, because I haven't mentioned anything about radio yet. I said optical emission lines and infrared, things like that. But the radio does something very interesting. So if you were to look in the radio, that's where there's this neutral hydrogen line at 21 centimeters. And so it's stretched because it's halfway across the universe. So instead of being at 21 centimeters, it might be at 210 centimeters, which means it's, you know, a good distance, right? Bigger than me. But then if you think about that for a second, you say, wait a second, how big is a TV antenna? And the TV antenna is about that big. And that's why you can't do this in New Mexico, because too many people watch TV. Okay, but if you were to look at the universe in neutral hydrogen, so maybe we can look over there. So right at the Big Bang, you didn't have any atoms. You didn't have any hydrogen. You only had protons and electrons. They were never combined. Instead, sort of just before the first stars formed, you have these atoms, and they're sitting there, and they're not doing anything interesting. Remember, that's the problem. They aren't doing anything interesting. They're not bumping into each other. They're not radiating. They're just sitting there. If you go a little bit further, eventually what's going to happen is you get little pockets of these things broken up. So what this is all neutral gas. If you could look in hydrogen, you'd start seeing little holes in the distribution. Like there's a hole there, and then the holes get bigger and bigger and bigger. And what's going on? And you have to think about this for a second. You have to say, so I had all these happy little atoms, and they were sitting there, and now something's going on. And then, aha, so stars produce ionizing radiation. So this, here's an X-ray view of the sun. You go, wow, that's ionizing radiation. So if you've ever been freaked out about your getting a CT scan or something, that's ionizing radiation. But there's also ionizing radiation, which we all, I suspect all, have experienced, which is sunburn. That's ionizing radiation, right? That's ultraviolet light coming in and wreaking havoc with the stuff in your body. And it's breaking little bonds apart, and it's just causing a big mess. And that's all ionizing radiation means. It means that it's going in and it's peeling electrons off from where they're supposed to be. And so we know that our sun is very good at producing ionizing radiation, because even with this lovely atmosphere above us blocking all this ultraviolet light, if you go outside, and so if we do it tomorrow, of course we've been inside all winter, you're going to end up looking like this, right? You're going to get sunburn. So stars are producing ionizing radiation. So as soon as stars turn on, you're going to start blowing apart all the little neutral hydrogens in the local environment, which means you're going to, if you're looking for neutral hydrogen, you'll just see little holes in the distribution. And so here's a movie by a guy, Nick Nedden, at Fermilab, who's been running what at least... until about maybe 6 months ago, is the largest simulation anyone's ever been able to do of what happens when the first stars formed. And what this is a cube showing the neutral hydrogen distribution. So it's imagine if you're God looking at the universe and watching sort of the thing evolve. So this thing's 50 million light years across. But remember, the universe today is 13.7 billion years old, which is to say this is a tiny little fraction of the observable universe, a tiny fraction. However, if you really want to do this calculation, as you'll see in a second, it's just very difficult to do on such a large scale. So let's see if this works. And so time is going forward here, and you see a little dot over there. That's a first star sort of turning on somewhere. So all the stars are marked as yellow dots. And they're pumping out this ultraviolet light, and as the ultraviolet light propagates across the universe, it starts basically blowing apart all these little atoms. And so what you're seeing here is basically the entire universe getting a sunburn from the inside out. It's basically blowing a hole in its local environment. And slowly but surely, it's just taking over. The first ones to form these giant bubbles. And then you're getting new ones coming, and they're carving out new bubbles. And then eventually, these bubbles start to overlap, and then they go very much faster. And then as it evolves, eventually you see that after a short amount of time, all the neutral hydrogen has just been blown away. It's all just been turned, it's been ionized. And if you were to now do a little pencil beam survey through the universe, you would basically see just a few little lumps of neutral hydrogen. And in fact, if you look around today, it's only about 10 parts in a million are neutral. And the rest is all in this form where the electrons are separated from the protons. So if you can look at the very beginning when you had those big giant bubbles, you can actually take a picture of those and see the area around those first stars. And that's what people are trying to do with the radio telescopes. Now, another way to look at those bubbles is through its imprint on how it affects the afterglow from the Big Bang. And that's something I'm involved with and that we're involved with here at McGill, something called the South Pole Telescope. And so that is a 10-meter millimeter wave telescope that's at the South Pole, surprisingly. And you might think, why would anyone go to the South Pole? Well, it turns out the South Pole is an excellent place to do microwave studies and millimeter studies. And the main reason for that is that it's extremely dry. So it turns out when it's minus 40 all the time on a good day, there's not much water in the atmosphere. A lot of it's condensed out. On top of that, that for now we have that very large ice sheet in Antarctica, so the South Pole is actually at about 8,000 feet. So it's already got a bit of, it's fairly high, it's extremely cold, so it's very dry. You only have one day, right? The sun comes up and then it goes down 6 months later. So it's extremely stable. And when you have something that's 10 meters, so think about 10 meters, right? That's basically the size of this room, which means if you have the sun sort of going up and over and then setting, it's going to heat up different parts of the telescope, and the telescope will sort of start to vibrate, you know, just sag a little bit and move back and forth. So the fact that there's only this one day a year makes things very stable. And paradoxically, there's actually very good support down there because the Antarctica is basically demilitarized. And so the U.S. government has a strong commitment to maintaining an active program for supporting activities at the South Pole. They can't do it for military purposes, so they support science down there. So it is a very nice place to work. And in fact, this bottom picture right down here is a picture of the South Pole telescope, which looks much better on my screen. So there it is in shadows. That is a real picture. That is the Milky Way behind it. And that thing down there at the bottom is an aurora. So he did live there. He wintered over. So he babysat our telescope. What was that?
Who cares about winter?
Well, they tell stories like when it gets to minus 100 Fahrenheit, they all go and they... So there's also a neutrino experiment there, where they drill giant holes in the ice, and when you're drilling through the ice, you actually want to do it with a water cannon. You just basically pump hot water down there, and it's a very good drill. But I've heard stories that when it hits minus 100, they all go and run outside and jump into the giant tub of hot water. And you think, minus 100? That sounds cold. But it's a great site for doing astronomy. Keith Vanderlinde was the guy who made this picture, and our current winter over is this one. That's the moon in behind the telescope. So it's a beautiful place to work. It's a great site. We have all sorts of data. And we're suspecting that sort of in the next year or so, we should actually start making inroads on measuring some of the signatures of those bubbles. So that's what we can do in the millimeter. You can also do things in the optical. And so this is one of the first images that came out of the refurbished Hubble. So after they went up and they fixed the camera, so this is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. And so it's actually, it's got a very powerful infrared camera. And so it's actually, you're not actually missing anything. It really should be almost impossible to see any dots in there. There are little tiny dots in there, and each one of those is a galaxy that we think happened about halfway through the process of those first stars forming. So when you imagine those little bubbles overlapping, about halfway through that is where we think those things have come from. And so that's one way we can go after these things. As our telescopes get better, we'll just keep going deeper. Now, another way to go about it is instead of just saying, well, we'll go as deep as we can with what we've got, is to actually take advantage of nature's own telescope, which is what's known as a gravitational lens. And so what this is right here is a picture of a galaxy cluster, and what you should see is you should see some funny-looking things like this galaxy that looks like it's been speared. And what this spear is some very distant galaxy that's been gravitationally distorted. So it's exactly like any other lens you could imagine. It takes some image and it distorts it and makes it look different. And for gravitational lenses in particular, it has this property that it stretches them out this way. And so what this thing is right here it's some galaxy that was a little dot that was supposed to be seen there, but as it moved through the gravity of this big giant object, it got stretched out. And so we see it this way. Now, not only did it get stretched out, it got magnified. So this galaxy is intrinsically probably about that size. And in fact, this might be a different image of that galaxy. I'd have to think about the geometry for a second before I could say that for sure. This might be another copy of that galaxy, and it should naturally be about that size. Instead, it's way stretched out like this. And what that means is it's basically like a big zoom lens. So yes, it's been arced out into this big mess that makes no sense, but the fact is you can figure out exactly how it's been stretched out. You can undo that stretch, and once you've undone that stretch, it's almost like being able to zoom in on that galaxy at much higher resolution. And so what it lets you do is it lets you look much fainter. So in the spots where you have these big giant galaxy clusters, you can actually look at something like 100 times deeper than you could with just a straight up image.
How do you know how much better the lens looks like?
So there's two ways you can do it. So one way is that you can actually try to figure out how much mass is there just by looking at all these individual galaxies and how they're moving around. That's one way you can do it. The other way you can do it is that not only do you have this one here, you have another one down there, and there's another one right up there, and then there's some arcs there. So in a typical, well, not typical, in the best examples, you have something like 30 or 40 different galaxies that have been stretched out in different ways at different points in the gravitational potential. And there's only one big lump there, right? It's one big lump of mass. And if you have 40 different measurements of how it stretched things out, you can actually just basically use all the different, you could use all but one of those stretches to figure out exactly what the underlying lump of mass is and then go measure the very last lump, for instance. But you know, you have enough data sets. You have sort of a small number of unknowns and a large number of constraints. You can just solve for it in the end, is what most people do. So the long-term future of this, well, not even that long-term, is 2014, is the James Webb Space Telescope. And so what I just showed, this stuff is with the Hubble Space Telescope. That was state-of-the-art sort of 20 years ago or something, right? It's old. And they've refurbished it. They put in new cameras. But the fact is its telescope is only, its mirror is only about this big. And it's just getting left behind. I just showed you that in the millimeter we have a 10-meter telescope. And people are talking about building 30-meter optical telescopes or even bigger. So, you know, it's time to replace it. And what they're replacing it with is this thing that's called the James Webb Space Telescope. And it's 6.5 meters. So it's a good size. It'll keep things going for a while. And it should be able to image. So if you remember that movie, sort of the stuff forming the mid-size bubbles, it should be able to take pictures of those things. Almost directly, just the actual stars and the collections of stars forming those mid-sized bubbles will be directly imaged by this thing. So launch is 2014, I hope, and it has a big Canadian connection. So an important part of it is being built by the Canadian Space Agency right here in Canada, the Fine Guidance Sensor. So basically, it'll know what it's doing because of Canada. Okay, so here's the summary. So the first stars are a major transition in the universe. So this was, it went from being completely dark to filled with light. So there are major theoretical and observational campaigns that are underway to characterize this. And so I'd say that over the next decade, this is a primary science goal. And almost all major telescopes that are being built these days have some component that is talking about how this is something that they're going to make a big impact on. And this research spans nearly all wavelengths for looking at things, and it has many, many branches of astrophysics. So it really is sort of a meeting place for many different people that are doing things from a lot of different angles. So it's a very active area of research. But that's it. So I'll take questions.
Gil, we'll now take some questions for Gil. So, who's first? Yes.
Yes, there's a lot of lectures recently about dark matter, and the impression I get as a layperson from your lecture is that there's a lot of empty space there, but how does the concept of the dark matter fit into your presentation?
I spend a lot of time working on dark matter and dark energy as well, something separate, but for these purposes, the dark matter is mainly just is acting as a skeleton for the whole thing. The star formation is happening in the, you know, you get big lumps of matter, and the matter turns out to be dark matter. But whether the dark matter was there or not, you would get the same process going. So what's nice about this is that it's sensitive to what the dark matter is doing, but it doesn't require the dark matter. So in many ways, this is a very nice complementary probe of exactly what the dark matter is, because you don't have to assume the dark matter to get everything to fall out, but on the other hand, it's a good way to map out exactly where all the lumps of dark matter are, and it gives you another handle on it. So.
Yes?
Yeah, I have a question. So you had a very accurate description, it seems, of the first minute. So on what is it based? Is that a theory or is that an experiment that's behind that?
So it's based on... in the end, it's a theory of where the first element of how you form elements. And basically, we understand pretty well how nuclear reactors work. And if you just look at the abundance that we see of, say, hydrogen relative to helium with a little bit of lithium and still some deuterium. So just from observing the very light elements, what you can say is that wherever these things were formed, the temperature had to be about 10 to the 10 Kelvin, and it had to all happen in a few minutes. And so then the question is, where would that happen in the universe? And no one has come up with a reliable place in the universe where it gets to 10 to the 10 Kelvin for only a few minutes. And it's circumstantial. But it fits in very nicely with this idea that if you start with a universe that was hot, if you move the Big Bang back before a minute and just let it cool off, then it will go through a phase where it just perfectly gives you exactly what we see in terms of these abundance patterns. And so from the details of the abundances, you can say exactly how fast the universe had to be expanding, which is to say how long it lasted. And so we know pretty well how long it had to have lasted, and we know pretty well how hot it had to be. But in general, how hot it had to be gets set by the fact that you managed to ram two hydrogens into each other and make a helium. So it's in many ways circumstantial, but it's incredibly difficult to get around it. That in 50 years of trying to figure this out, no one has come up with any other way to do this.
Okay, question at the back here.
You were talking about the expansion of the universe. Is that expansion exponential or linear?
Well, so that's a remarkably sensible question. So, up until about 15 years ago, we were pretty sure that the expansion was slowing down, that it wasn't linear, it was sublinear. So it was getting bigger, and it was getting bigger at a the rate was going down, is what we were pretty darn sure of. It had to be true, that if you throw a ball up, it comes back down. In the same way you throw the universe up, it's got to come back down. And maybe if you throw it hard enough, it might get out into orbit and never quite make it back, but it's going to keep slowing down the whole time, right? That had to be true. And instead, what we discovered is that the universe is actually accelerating, that the expansion is getting faster, that it's the equivalent of throwing a ball up, watching it slow down, and then take off. And it really is very close to that analogy. And that's and we have no idea what's going on in that.
You don't know why.
No one knows exactly what's going on. We've given it a name. We've named it dark energy. So we've given it a name, and dark energy is that the universe is today starting to accelerate. And if it keeps accelerating this way, it will become exponential in about another 10 billion years or something. It'll get on. So right now it's sort of going in this transition. It's almost linear right now, actually. It's very close to linear right now. But it's about to enter a phase where it's going to start take off and start going exponential.
Okay, another question here.
I've read often that it seems that dark energy is a product of empty space.
That's one theory for it.
The more empty space you have, the more dark energy you have as a consequence of that. So my question is, if we go back all the way to the Big Bang, was there any dark energy at all?
No. So it's not that it's not there. It's not that it's not there. It's just that you can only see it now. So the mystery of dark energy is not that it's there. It's that we don't understand why it is only something which seems to be affecting the universe today. That's the big mystery. Like, why is there this thing that the whole past history of the universe has not cared about, And suddenly it's now becoming interesting. And that's because it's at this really low level. So as you said, it's, you know, you get more space, you get more dark energy, but the amount per cubic centimeter is actually the same. Whereas you run the clock backwards on the universe, you take the universe, you make it 2 times smaller, it becomes 8 times denser. So today we notice that in a little cell, there's a little bit more dark energy than there is normal matter. So a factor of 2 or something. But if you go back even half the age of the universe or 2/3 of the age of the universe, there's going to be something like 5 or 6 times more normal matter than dark energy. And then you run it all the way back to the beginning. The dark energy is still there, but it's just this tiny little amount. It's such a small amount that no one cares about it. Like when we were talking about Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the density of the universe then is water. It's about 1 gram per cc. So back when the universe was 10 to the 10 Kelvin, it was about 1 gram per cubic centimeter. Whereas we're talking about the universe today, the dark energy effective density, you're talking about the equivalent of a few hydrogen atoms in a big box.
Okay. Take your first one.
No, no, it's an opportunity. If you are a funding agent, okay. I'll see what I can do.
Yeah, I'm just curious about how the history of stars is actually observed. I don't understand how the dark ages, for example, have come into the theory of science.
So what we can say is that we see stars forming nearby, right? So we don't know for sure that we can say that the universe made some transition where there were no atoms. Sorry, no. It must have been all atoms until the universe was a few hundred million years old. And we know that because we can actually see the microwave background. So we can see this afterglow from the Big Bang, and we see little lumps in it. And if all the way along that line of sight it was full of electrons, all those electrons actually ping light out of the beam, which means you wouldn't be able to see any lump. It'd be almost like looking through a fog across the city that you just don't see any lumps coming from one spot. You just see sort of this diffuse glow coming from everywhere. So we know that there had to be some phase where there were neutral atoms. So that had to be. Now, if you have stars, you can't have neutral atoms, right? That's what we saw in that movie, that it just blows, it vaporizes these neutral atoms. So if you have neutral atoms, you can't have many stars. Now, whether there are no stars, empirically, we can't say anything about that. We can't say there were no stars. We can put upper limits on how many stars are there. And we know that there weren't many. So we know that there was a big burst of star formation somewhere in the hundreds of millions of years for the universe. So that's the sense in which they were dark.
Question here?
Yeah. What do you say about the rate of the star formation? Is it something that is likely to stop at a certain point? And does stuff that gets destroyed with the star get recycled into new ones?
So it's definitely true that stuff gets recycled into new ones all the time. That generally, I don't know exactly what the number is, but we have been through several generations. The atoms in your body, they've been through several generations of stars already. So what we can do is when we look at those deep images, we can say that there was much more star formation when the universe was younger. Roughly half a universe ago, star formation really started to peter out. And understanding exactly why star formation today is so much less efficient than it was in when the universe was younger is something we're trying to figure out. So, for instance, our galaxy is forming stars at the rate of around like the mass of a sun per year, something like that, in the whole galaxy. In our whole Milky Way, that's what we're getting. There's sort of one new sun's worth appearing every year. Whereas when you look at a galaxy that would otherwise look like our galaxy, but when the universe was maybe maybe a fifth of its current age, that thing would be forming maybe 100 times that amount. And, you wouldn't necessarily think it would be all that different, because remember, I had this story that all it depends on is cooling, and it cools and cools and cools until it stops because of some very small-scale thing. It's hard to understand why the very smallest scale would care about the age of the universe. So that's one of the mysteries, and we're trying to understand exactly what's going on there. So there are lots of problems figuring out why the star formation rate is doing what it's doing. But it's you know, it's observable, and it's what we're doing.
Okay, one last question, and we'll close.
Does the observed length of the dark ages, that is 380,000 years to 400 million, does that agree with the theoretical model, which is presumably some kind of statistical mechanical model of how many collisions would occur in a given volume, et cetera, et cetera? Or, I mean, because there seems to be something basically unsatisfying about any explanation that any explanation of how we get from a presumably uniform state at the beginning of the Dark Ages to a very heterogeneous and very uneven state.
Well, I mean, so part of this is the weird is that gravity is something that I think. In terms of understanding the large-scale thermodynamics of the universe, gravity's weird. You know, as I said, we're all going to end up in a black hole eventually. And that's, you know, it's a little weird, right? There's this sort of inevitability to the process where gravity is setting this whole clock. And so what you can say is you can say, well, we know that it takes gravity some amount of time to get up to be able to squeeze any bit of gas to 10,000 Kelvin. And that's going to take time. And if you just say how long is that going to take, given everything else we know about the universe, and that actually requires dark matter to get the clock to work right. Without dark matter, the clock is a little bit off. But when you put the dark matter in and you run the clock forward, you say, okay, the first star should be forming right around there, around 300 million years, whatever the number, it's somewhere around there. And in fact, that was predicted before we actually had a real solid observation of that that number. There's a story that WMAP satellite, when they first did their result of exactly how big this haze was, so we've measured that there's a little bit of haze, that there are some electrons between us and the Big Bang. And they did that measurement, and the number they got turns out to be about a factor of two larger than what we think it is today. And which is pretty good, but it moved the end of the Dark Ages back by almost a factor of three. And actually, a lot of people actually said, well, this is actually really hard to understand. The only way we can make this work is by actually fiddling around with the physics that we think is relevant. And a lot of people were trying to use molecular hydrogen as some way to get the cooling to work. And, people were throwing up their hands and saying, the physics that we think is working can't do this. And then over time, as their data got better, they sort of cranked it down a little bit. And now we're in this situation where the theorists actually feel like they have a complete understanding of when the Dark Ages should end. And the observers are all going out to prove them wrong.
Okay, that's a good place to stop. Well, thank you very much, Gil. Let us thank our speaker. And I would like to thank all the audience for coming. Many of you have come over and over again, and we look forward to seeing you again next September, when we'll commence again with a new series. And, of course, as our usual tradition, we invite you to meet the speaker and others for a glass of wine and a piece of cheese. So thank you again very much. That was great.
Thank you.
Wonderful presentation.
Thanks.
Enjoy that? Do you enjoy doing these?